righty, let's get going. Good morning, everybody. It's about 11 o'clock on March 26th. It's a Monday. You're listening to the What Now Show on KOWS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California. Very happy to have in the studio Ed Frankel. Ed Frankel is a poet of merit, which is a big deal in our book. We want and need poets of who have the chops and can penetrate the fog of the very dangerous daily life that we are enmeshed in, kind of a de-hypnotizing art form, among other things. Let's see if we have you on the right microphone. Good morning, Ed.
Hi.
Right into the microphone. Maybe I got the wrong one. Let's try it again.
Is this working?
No. Well, let's try it one more time.
And now?
Why don't you move the microphone close to your mouth, right up against it, and one more time. Hello?
How's this?
Speak up, Ed. Come on.
How's this?
That's good.
Okay.
That'll do. Well, welcome. Welcome to the studio, and very happy to have you here. The best I can do for an introduction is to take it off one of your published works, and you can tell me if it's up to date or if it's relevant, or you can introduce yourself. But Ed Frankel divides his time between Northern California, Sonoma County, and Los Angeles, where he teaches at the UCLA Writing Program for the UCLA Writing Programs and at Antioch University, Los Angeles. His poetry has appeared in Fugue, the Dogwood Journal of Poetry, Nimrod, Pedestal, and other journals. His chapbook, People of the Air, was published fairly recently by New American Press. And very happy to have you sitting in our chair.
Thank you, Ken.
How shall I call you? You don't like the term professor?
I hate the term professor.
Okay, because?
I don't have my students call me professor unless they feel compelled to. I like it people to people, I guess.
Okay, so I should call you Mr. Frankel?
How about Ed?
How about Ed?
Yeah.
Okay. Ed, is it okay to say that you're a practicing poet?
I practice every day.
And you've been practicing for quite a few years.
It's been about 20 years. I went back to it after doing it a lot when I was younger. So yeah, I've been practicing.
Was there a time when you actually crossed the border and actually became from someone who was you know, who
I mean, did I start taking it really seriously?
Yeah, did you start identifying as a poet?
When I started writing about 20 years ago, I promised myself a couple things. I said I would write 3 hours a day, no matter what came out. I would try and have a decent time doing it and not kick myself in the behind too much. But, you know, I don't know that I took myself as a, saw myself as a poet until I started getting some stuff recognized and published, and then I realized I always had something to say, but I realized I had something to say that people might want to hear, and so
yeah.
I've been into it as the major kind of focus of my life, probably for 20 years.
Great. I thought you were going to say you started to identify as a poet when you began to be seriously rejected.
There's a lot of rejection, and I don't submit all that much. I like to read my poems to friends. I'll do the occasional reading. I do send stuff out. But I learned that rejection just doesn't necessarily mean the stuff is not of merit. And we know many, many stories of people whose books have been rejected over and over again. And we know how good some of that stuff is. So I've learned to kind of work my way around that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the pleasure of reading some of your stuff over the last week, and it works for me. And I can't say that about the great majority of poetry that I see in different places. So I really value stuff that clicks.
What is it that works for you?
You know, it's, you mean generally
in the, in this, in my poetry?
Oh, the lines, the nourishment or the nutrition. Words to me are very powerful, and when I feel that words are chosen with care or with precision, and especially when they're put together in combinations, then they pack a wallop. And I was thinking of actually reading a little bit of your poetry here, but I don't know if I'm going to do that. We have the luxury of a lot of time here. I'm hoping that you're going to read a lot for us.
I'm ready to read.
You're ready to read. Why don't you read?
You know, I'm going to start with a poem about Federico Garcia Lorca, who's probably one of the predominant Spanish poets of the 20th century. When the Spanish Civil War started, Lorca returned to his home in Granada, and he was one of the first people that Franco and the fascists picked up and summarily executed, in part because he was openly gay in a country where that really was anathema, but also because he identified with working-class people. He hung out on the wrong side of the tracks with gypsies and with artists. He was very close with Salvador Dali and with Buñuel, and he kind of represented the kind of liberal side of Spanish art. So he was killed. His grave was never really found. And so this is a poem about Garcia Lorca. I'm going to start it off with a little quote that has one of his most famous lines in it. I'll read it in Spanish first because I guess it kind of deserves that. Translate it and then read the poem. So this is Garcia Lorca becomes his own poem, and the epigraph comes from his poem, Ballad of the Sleepwalker. Verde, que te quiero, verde. Grandes estrellas de escarcha vienen con el pez de sombra que abra el camino del alba. Green, how I would love you, green. Giant stars of frost come with the shadows, fish of darkness that open the way to the dawn. And a couple of words here that I'll translate from the Spanish. Pájaro, joto, and maricón are pejoratives for homosexual. And canto hondo is the predecessor of a flamenco deep song, which is, if nothing else, kind of like Spanish blues, you might say. The red cross on the sergeant's lapel was a vein in a bull's neck quivering. The sound of the civil guard's rifles staggered blue steel genuflections. He winced in the headlights, extended his hands to fend off the bullets. Pájaro, joto, maricón. 4 a.m. in a shallow pit on the road between Viznar and Alfacar, alongside the Oscuro Galindo González, a lame schoolteacher, and 2 anarchist bullfighters. A bucket of quicklime thrown as an afterthought. The guards picked up their spent cartridges, flicked their cigarettes at the grave. Sparks flew as they spit and walked away. It's a shallow grave to swim out of, Federico, white-faced and streaked vermilion. But after the Civil War in 1938 in La Taverna Camborio, when the doors were locked and closed after hours, and the smoke and the absinthe clouded the windows, the guitarist Manuel Vélez played a carcelera, a llanto, the lament of one unjustly imprisoned. Pastora Pavón, la niña de las penes, the girl of the combs, sang Ay Carmela, how it said that the gypsies pulled Lorca from the shallows before the quicklime burned his pale skin clean, his body paltry and undone, the brevity of bone. They lay him on a cooling board, washed him with spikenard oil and jasmine. They placed chips of turquoise on his eyes. In their passion gardens, they wove necklaces of dried marigolds and tiny apples, sewed his songs shut in the mouths of lizards under green moonlight, and braided shadows into his hair. They scattered breadcrumbs and flower seeds, called the birds to flutter around his eyes. They buried him standing upright in their fashion, where the willows grow on the tongues of rivers, down by the cottonwoods, so his bones would settle under the remote pitch of the starlight, his green and point-blank moon.
Lorca lived when?
Lorca lived, he was executed in 1936, so he was writing and in really in his prime from the early 20s into the 30s, 36.
And he grabbed you?
He grabbed me when I was really young, actually. I heard a song on an old album by the Weavers. It was a Pete Seeger group. And it was a Spanish Civil War song called Venga Jaleo. And the song just knocked me over. But the melody was his, but the words were songs of the Republicans from the Spanish Civil War. So I tracked down the song, and it turned out to come from a book of songs that Lorca collected. And he had put his own words to it, and then the Spanish Republicans put their words to it. And once I started reading his stuff, I was pretty taken. So, Lorca captured my imagination, you might say, when I was about 15. At one point, I used to be able to recite all of his gypsy ballads. That's gone. But yes, you're right. He captured my imagination.
Do you teach Lorca?
I do sometimes teach Lorca. He's very readable. He's Spanish, and the images are often a little remote for people. But I do teach him, and he goes over really well.
Yeah. Are you fluent?
You know, I used to be pretty fluent. I worked as a translator many, many years ago. I started translating Spanish poetry, and I realized that I didn't want to try and translate because I really couldn't get the connotations the way I wanted to, and you know, just working in English was hard enough. But I was pretty fluent. I have a grandfather who lived in Argentina. I worked with the farm workers during the grape strike in Delano for 3 years, and I did a lot of translating on a job in a predominantly Spanish or Latino community in L.A., so at one time, fluent,
right.
Not anymore.
Have you traveled?
I've traveled a lot, yeah. I taught in Mexico. I've been to Europe, to Spain, India. I've been abroad a bit. Ireland, I just finished reading at the Strokestown Poetry Festival in Ireland. And so
where in Ireland?
Strokestown. It's right between halfway between Galway and Dublin, right smack dab in the middle, where they still speak Gaelic. It's the first language for a lot of people. That was a real wonderful surprise.
That's something to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, they take great pride in their language. They're remarkably passionate about language and in fact, I when I read, I had an old piece that I had written about James Joyce, about one of his books, and I said near the end of the reading, I said, "Well, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to read a poem about Joyce. I know he's your guy, but I'm going to read the poem." Yeah. And I couldn't buy a Guinness for 3 nights after that. It was just wonderful. They were probably the friendliest place. I think the friendliest place I've ever really been. They were just wonderful, warm people.
Yeah, yeah. I visited Ireland a number of years ago for a while. I traveled around, and you can't not love a country that has a pub, a betting parlor, and a church on every corner.
I had one interesting experience there. During the reading, one of the fellows was reading in Gaelic, and then they brought in a couple of local musicians, a fiddler and a guitar player. And they were folk musicians, but they were local working-class guys. They had great big old ham hands, and they started playing really quite old fiddle tunes. And spontaneously, a couple guys from the audience just stood up and started dancing. Just dancing.
Absolutely.
And then there were two young women sitting in front of me. They were probably 15 or 16. They could have been teenagers from New York. They were pierced. They had their hair kind of hip. And damn if one of them didn't get up and start dancing traditional Irish folk dancing. It was authentic. It was real. It was natural. And God, it was just beautiful to watch.
Yeah. Do you have the Joyce piece with you?
You know, I do have the Joyce piece with me. I could I'll read that.
I'd love to hear it. We'd love to hear it.
So this is called
this is Ed Frankel, ladies and gentlemen.
This is called The Other Thing Joyce Joyce Said. Among other things Joyce said, Ulysses was about, quote, ineluctable certitude and the affirmation of the void. The one word everyone knows speaks for itself, and facts, like the body, that hermetic organ sealed in its own warm juices, takes on a beauty of their own. The big yes and the big no ply their oily questions and answers, push and pull, until tendon answers tendon and bone answers bone, and the wind shakes the barley. Even the gods couldn't change fate. Zeus wept at the death of Sarpedon, his half-human son, consoled, if gods are consoled, by whatever engendered the fire that turns bone wrapped in fat to smoldering ash. Lots of certainty for Homer, who knew his listeners would reach out for their spears when the suitors abused Penelope. Paris, that powder pigeon, swelled up with the truth of his member, the courage and morality of a gland. Helen, in the end, murmured her regrets, which is more than most of them did. Blazes Boynton, another puffed up pigeon. Molly has her doubts about him when he pats her behind like the rump of a racehorse he's certain will win before the dark horse makes it home. She loves him. She loves him not. What is the word everyone knows? Sooner or later, we all deal with the big no, which also speaks for itself from across the abyss, assumes the position, neck outstretched, hisses like a goose, and eats its own children. The rest is all hearsay and secondhand experience. What we hear on the street or read in the free man's journal that Bloom sold ads for and carried under his arm. Young Stephen Dedalus, wet and green, the imperfect prince of a bankrupt king, sets out on the same waters we all cross, behind our special oar, not yet lying with our gear on our chest, slathered in pitch and oil, soon to light up the limb-loosening darkness. Or is it just as simple as that kidney in the beginning of Ulysses, a bit overcooked, sealed in its juices, left frying in the pan? As simple as whatever is exchanged between us at this moment, mute as the currents of the ocean, or this hermetic vessel, sleek hold enough to ride out the storm or wait out the doldrums while we find our seat at the rowing bench, dip in the oars and pull, pull, till we get the thing moving again, until the right wind comes up to take us out to the open sea, where we look to Orion and the pole star to guide us home to Ithaca, or that narrow house on Eccles Street, where we lay head to foot in our feathery bed, navigate the swells and doubts from beneath the scented sheets. The musk-blown yes fills the room in blousy clouds of memory. Long perfumey breaths that shut our eyes, which is not the darkness of limb-loosening death. And we listen to the warm sap run in the living tree of our marriage bed.
Ed, what form of poetry is this? Is there? I mean, no. At the beginning when we first began, you asked me something about poetry, and I said something about words and putting words together. I was actually alluding to a different form of poetry. This to me is almost like a song. These are like songs.
songs because
there's something that you can you don't have to you don't so much hang on every word as let the lines wash over you. You kind of relax and there's a rhythm. There's a rhythmic a comfort. And one gets the feeling that this is going to go on for a while. Not that doesn't sound good, but it is. It's generous and it's abundant, and it strikes me as a song. I'm not a student of poetry. Is this a particular form of poetry?
Is it a form of poetry? Well, it doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have a set a rhythm scheme. Most of the stuff that I write tends to be more narrative in the sense that it tells a story, but it has the lyric moments that kind of, if nothing else, stop time and sort of sing, or at least that's what I try and get. I used to be a musician. I listen carefully to the sound and the music of the words. I think that's one of the bottom lines of poetry.
Yeah. You must have a sizable body of work.
I have a sizable body of work. Yes, I do.
Do you group them? Do you clump them? Do you organize them in some fashion? Do you have your Spanish work? Do you have your Irish work? Do you have your how do you?
I don't know that I group them per se. Although in the larger books that I have, there tends to be a kind of theme behind them. So in one of the books, the larger books, the title is The Middens. And middens are those places that archaeologists discover of really quite old peoples. And the middens are layers of mounds of things that were thrown away. And in those things that were thrown away, anthropologists can study a lot and learn a lot about the particular culture. So I called the book The Middens because I have always been interested in people, historical people, who have been kind of thrown away by history or have been kind of elided or left out or omitted from history. So that particular book has poems in it about Spartacus, who led the slave rebellion against Rome, or it has poems in it about Hypatia of Alexandria, who was a famous philosopher who was killed by the church because she was so popular, or Sor Juana de la Cruz, who was a famous Mexican poet from the 1600s in Mexico that the church finally kind of shut down kept her from writing more poems. It has things in there about Lorca, for example, or about the dirty war in Argentina and what happened to the desaparecidos, the disappeared.
Yeah.
So, I've always been concerned about what's been left out of history. And so The Middens kind of picks up on that theme. I think a lot of it has to do with working class folks who have been kind of, who are invisible in a funny way. A friend of mine once described some of my poems about, she said they were about the invisible people trying to turn the world or spin the world on a different axis. And so I guess a lot of my poems are concerned about what I would call the invisible people. Yeah. And then there's other poems that are, you know, a couple of love poems, poems about things that I've always wanted to kind of figure out, why I liked Jack Spicer, the poet, for example, why I liked Lorca, for example. What was it about his art that pulled me? Or I have the chapbook about John Fahey, who was a musician that I was quite taken with in the 60s, and I never quite understood what the mystery was that pulled me to his music. And I don't know that after writing the book, and I spent probably a year writing the book, I don't know that I really came up with an answer any more than I learned a little more about what I liked about him, but I never got to the bottom of things. So a lot of my poems I've used to kind of investigate why I'm kind of pulled towards certain kinds of art or certain kinds of people. I wouldn't say that my stuff is real self-referential. I'm in all my poems, I'm sure. And a friend of mine once said, well, you know, Ed, you are everyone in your poems. But they tend not to talk a lot about me directly. I don't find that particularly interesting.
Yeah. You discover as you go.
I do. And you know, they say, you know, if there's no discovery for the writer, then there's no discovery for the reader. And discovery is a very exciting part, I think, at least for me, about writing poetry. Yeah, yeah. For sure.
I've been fascinated with the music of John Fahey for many, many years, and I found your poems, your book about him, very helpful.
Helpful in what way?
They kind of provided me with a skeleton upon which I could that would hold up all the kind of semi-inchoate ideas and impressions I had from listening to him, because he was so, in a way, unapproachable, or he was beyond my capacity to get him.
He was very mysterious, and in some ways he made himself that way. He kind of built a myth around himself, I'm pretty sure. Of that, and then he kind of resented in some ways the fact that he had made a myth out of himself, and people were attracted to that myth. But at the same time, he was a very unusual musician, one of his kind, probably the first of his kind to take essentially blues or folk guitar work on a steel string guitar and just use it to play songs, but he used open tunings, which means he got very unusual sounds out of his guitar because he tuned the guitar in different ways. So I was also just pulled into his stuff, and he invested a lot of it with philosophy and with a lot of the lore about blues, because he was a very early collector of blues. In his teens, he lived in Maryland, and in his teens, he went down south collecting blues. He discovered Book of White. He discovered Skip James. Back in the 50s, he was really quite early. And so I still don't know that I've understood Fahey, but I've certainly spent some time with him. In fact, in the chapbook, there's a little story, because in the early 60s, it would have been 64, I was living above a coffee house in Los Angeles. It was the Mother Neptune's. It was Christmas Eve, and I was there with a couple of friends. I was kind of noodling around on my guitar, and Fahey walked in, and I knew who he was. But at that point, I had been to a couple of his concerts at the Ashgrove in L.A., and he came in, and he had a Coke bottle that he was carrying by the neck. And I found out, you know, later that he usually kept some whiskey mixed with Coke in the bottle. And he came up and he sat down and he saw the guitar. And it was a Gibson with a kind of red top to it, reddish top. And he said, and he had a kind of drawl. And he said, wow, haven't seen a guitar with a red top before. He said, can I take a look at it? And sure enough, I passed it over and he tuned it to an open tuning. And he played Christmas carols for about an hour. And I was just, we were just knocked over. And then he stood up, and he talked a little bit, but stood up, walked away.
Yeah.
John Fahey. And then funny enough, I got a job playing music at a restaurant. I was playing guitar at a restaurant in Venice in L.A. And I was playing a Fahey piece. And this guy walks in, and he sits down, listens to the piece, and he says, oh, that's a John Fahey piece. And I said, yeah, it's a John Fahey piece. And he says, well, you know, I play with John. I'm his cousin. Maybe you'd like to come meet him. And I was loaded at the time, and I was trying to be really cool. And I said, well, yeah, you know, that'd be really – why don't you come back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. And I was too cool for my own boots, because, of course, the guy never came back, and that was the end of the story.
Yeah.
But Fahey's been in and out of my life for a long time.
Yeah. I'd like you to read some of this work, but first, I want you to squeeze in a love poem if you have any there. Do you have a love poem?
I do. I do have. I have a love poem. It's a poem. It's a poem for my wife, actually. Let's see if I can find it. Here it is.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Philadelphia till I was 17, and then I came to Los Angeles and spent time in L.A., and then I was kind of...
What brought you to Los Angeles?
I just wanted to... I had, you know, not, early 60s, I had On the Road by Kerouac under my arm. Couldn't get away from Philadelphia fast enough.
Right.
L.A.
Yep.
So my wife's a doctor now, but she used to fish in Alaska for a number of years. And
for a living?
Yeah, for a living. Yeah, she fished. She had a dog team, a whole bunch of Alaskan vocations. So this is
where
this
did
is,
she grow up?
She grew up in Los Angeles. In fact, I knew her when she was 17. She was potting at a ceramics cooperative or pot shop, and I met her then, and I've known her for a long time.
What's her name?
Her name is Chris.
Okay.
So this is for Chris. There's a bar trick in here, and I'm sure she told me she learned it in Alaska, but she insists that she learned it someplace else. So this is the places I could visit but never stay. Now Alice would play the Bach cello suites in her slip, sustaining the vibrato, her long fingers pressing hard, drawing the bow across the thick fretless strings to find the tremolo that she said felt like a warm vibration in her breast, right through the rosewood back of her instrument. Sometimes she would hum along and look at me. I loved to feel her calloused fingertips when she touched my cheek, the strength of the tendons in her wrist. But Chris could take a cherry in her mouth while she looked me in the eye or up and away to that place where I could sometimes visit but never stay. Her eyes would narrow as she tied the stem with her tongue and then pushed the maraschino cherry out, handed it to me and smiled. An old Alaskan bar trick, she would say, and I would whisper, "Do it again." Probably the only love poem I wrote. Although I have to say that when I look at the names of some of these poems that I got in front of me, these are all people that I've been in a sense in love with, whether it's Lorca or whether it's Fahey or whether it's Mercedes Sosa or who it is. I think all of these in some ways are a kind of love poem.
Who's the Sosa?
Mercedes Sosa is a she just died recently. She was an Argentinian folk singer, very left-wing, who, when the dirty war started in Argentina, when the military coup took over essentially the government, she continued to sing her songs. They were called Nueva Canciones or Canciones Nuevas, which were kind of songs that really honored working class folks. And it was during that time that something like 36,000 people were, quote-unquote, disappeared. But all during that time, she kept singing until finally her life was in danger such that she finally left and went to Europe, came back after the dirty war was sort of over, and continued singing in Argentina. So she kind of represented a kind of voice against the dictatorship in Argentina. So I wrote some poems.
What were the years again, please?
This would have been, I think the dirty war would have started in the late 70s, 77, 78, ended in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Children were often taken away from their parents. The parents were killed. Sometimes pregnant women were taken away. The children were born, the women were killed, and then the children were given to families of the soldiers or officers. It was a very ugly time. There's still people looking for their grandchildren as we speak today.
Yeah. You have a poem for her?
Well, you know, the poem I have is a chapbook, and it kind of runs for 14 pages. I don't know if we want to. I don't know that we want to read that one.
We'll get the chapbook. How do we get your work if we want it?
Oh, how do we get it? I suppose the books are online on Amazon, People of the Air and the Fahey book, Requiem for John Fahey. A lot of the other stuff is on my website. It's edfrankel.com. I've posted most of the poems that are on there. There's several live readings that are on there. If you want any of the things that I read tonight that you can't find on the website, you send me an email. I'd be glad to send it to you.
Okay. Let's get to the Fahey. I'd love you to read some of it. The book is called When the Catfish Are in Bloom. That's a lyric from Mr. Fahey.
It is. It's a title of one of his songs. He named his songs oddly, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
One of them that I use here is called Georgia Stomps, Atlanta Struts, and Other Contemporary Dance Favorites.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read the first poem and then maybe another one. This one's called Sweet Spot. On a guitar, a sweet spot, well, on a tennis racket, for example, a sweet spot that is that place where you hit it, you know, and that's the best place to make contact with the ball. A sweet spot on a guitar is that place on the guitar where you really get that singing note that you've been looking for. So this is sweet spot. Once in the winter of 1964, I met John Fahey at Mother Neptune's, the coffee house by Los Angeles City College. I was 18, growing out my hair, and I had a joint in my pack of Chesterfields. As I counted on my burning fingers all the trespasses that would raise the lamp, that would cauterize the needle, to dip in ink from a broken ballpoint pen, blue stigmata carnations that someday would bloom as music inside my head, or later, now, as words on this page. John came in wearing a blue work shirt, jeans and a sport coat, which I thought were really cool in those days. He was holding his hands on his head so it wouldn't fall off, someone once joked. It was only later that I came to recognize the resolve of the posture, having been certain at times that if my own voice receded any further into the corner of the room, it would turn itself inside out and I would start talking in tongues and disappear like smoke from a signal fire out the top of my head. He was dangling a soda bottle by the neck, Jack Daniels mixed with Coca-Cola. He borrowed my Gibson with the faded reddish top and played Christmas songs in open tunings, one after another, until figures in white robes appeared up to their waists in a familiar river in the smoked-up windows of the coffee house, singing low, How a Rose Air Blooming. And he smiled once or twice like the Cheshire Cat. We three kings transfigured under the mixolydian colors of a modal star. Sometimes he seemed to move through himself like the current in that river, talking easy to me every once in a while, as if we were friends, a slow, droll voice, German philosophy that I didn't understand, of rivers and religion, how he used to go fishing for days at a time with Buka White when the catfish were in bloom. Buka White, who told him, "Be careful what you ask for, John. The past is really in front of you, before your eyes. The future is out behind. Maybe you need to learn to walk backwards in your own footprints, like a Seminole Indian." Joy to the world, finger-picked and syncopated, with a blues turnaround and an old-timey riff. A reverence for the mood, not the holiday. Whatever brooded over that river that we have given so many names. He finished with Silent Night, which he played like a Hawaiian lullaby with the back of a kitchen knife, sliding it up and down the neck of the guitar that he held tilted on his lap like a baby. "Nice little instrument with some decent sustain," he drawled. "You don't see many red guitars. You got a real sweet spot up around the 10th fret on the B string. It doesn't need much tremolo. You can feel it, can't you, in your hands and your chest, right through the sound box and fretboard." And I nodded my head. even though I didn't feel a thing.
Certainly recommend our listeners listen to some John Fahey if you're not familiar with him. And even if you are, it's...
Yeah, well, he was really the guitar player that opened up, no pun intended, open tuning for a lot of popular guitar players that followed him. Leo Kottke, who a lot of people know, really was a kind of protege of Fahey's. Fahey had a little record label for a while, and he even produced some of Kottke's records. But the open tuning, you know, Joni Mitchell used a lot of open tunings. Lots of folks used them. Fahey was the first guy to really bring it into the mainstream. Black blues musicians had been using them for years.
Mm-hmm. May I read a piece of this?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
This is I particularly like this section because this is our guest. This is Ed Frankel. This is really a number of lines. This is talking about Ed Frankel. I'm going to read this now. It's from a poem called The Second Age of Mechanical Reproduction from the chapbook When the Catfish Are in Bloom, Requiem for John Fahey by our guest poet Ed Frankel. He writes, I spent hours experimenting with the angles, the intensity of the attack, all the variations, how to file my nails, the degrees of pressure, what part of the finger presses down on the board, and how close to the fret. How to get that thick, fat sound with the fleshy tips of the finger, how to tamp and muffle the bass strings with my palm at the same time. How to tune down a half tone to soften the action or take it back up to find the shuffle and the bounce. How much space to leave between the notes and the phrases, whether to bend the note up or down, whether to play a chord as you inhale or exhale, or hold your breath while you barely remember from another lifetime before you had the words, the face of the woman emerging, as big as a sun, the perfumed and powdered hands. Perhaps these are not the right questions to ask a dead musician. Not the right questions at all. Well, I'm having a wonderful time listening and talking with you. You know your work. What would you like to share with us? We have a good 15-20 minutes left. Okay.
Well, we were talking about invisible people, and so I'll read this one. It's called Bahá'u'lláh, Delano, 1965, and it's about the Delano grape strike in a sense, but. Most people associate the Delano grape strike with Cesar Chavez and the Mexican-American movement of the 60s. But the fact was that the strike was started by the Filipino Farm Worker Union, the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee. And they went out on strike first. And Cesar had a group called the National Farm Workers Association. And they knew that they had to support the strike if they were going to be a viable progressive organization. And then they went out about 2 weeks later. But the strike was started by the Filipino Union, and they had been active organizing in the fields for a long time. They were very violent strikes in the 30s. And a lot of the Filipino farm workers, many of the ones that I met, were folks that had been men that had been soldiers during the Second World War. And when the Second World War started, Franklin Delano Roosevelt drafted the Filipino Army into the American Army, and he promised all the soldiers they would get veterans' benefits when the war was over. And a lot of these soldiers became the scouts for the Americans in the Philippines. Right. They served remarkably, bravely, and honorably, But when it came time after the war to collect their benefits, another law was passed, and they were refused the benefits. It was only about 5 or 6, maybe 8 years ago that that law was turned over, and they started getting their benefits. But by that time, there was only about 20,000 of them left, and you know, maybe 100,000, even more, had already passed away. And I was quite friendly with some of these Filipino men. I really enjoyed their company. I liked the stories they told about the Philippines. And so this is a poem about Delano and about the Filipino farm workers in Delano. I'll mention a couple of words that need translating. Bahala na is a Filipino phrase. It's Tagalog. And it can mean a whole lot of things. It can mean as God wills. It can mean that you're ready to meet any challenge, because it was the motto of one of the Filipino brigades during the Second World War. It can also mean things like, well, whatever happens, happens. I reference Eskrima in the poem. It's the Filipino martial art. Anting-antings are religious and spiritual tattoos that people wear, men wear in the Philippines, women as well, I suppose. And then Texas shorties are short-handled hoes that farm workers use when they're thinning or weeding. So this is called Bahala Na, Delano, 1965. At night on Main Street, red lights string muted rubies in the tule fog. Histories of three-card monte, AC Ducey and Mochi's Bar, shy visits to Lola's place behind the Starlight Bowling Alley, cockfights and knife fights retold in Tagalog and Pidgin English, a scream of dreams, Bahala Na, whatever happens, happens. Lucky Lucay, Julian Baladoy, Rudy Sulete, Angel Cabalas, winners of Purple Hearts, Silver Stars, and government commendations. Those scouts, point men and coast watchers, those slick-haired boys who jitterbugged in pre-war Manila or dove for oysters with goggles made from glass bottle bottoms in the lagoons of Cebu and Mindanao, who led GIs from Texas and South Philadelphia through the bamboo jungles. Now they walk toward vanishing points and perimeters, pruning shears slung over their shoulders instead of carbines. The straw boss can't get their names right. Asparagus knives and Texas shorties in hands as hard as the soles of your shoes. They water gardens of winter squash and bitter melon. Men without women behind the barracks in the labor camps. They cook adobo in outdoor kitchens in Early Mart and Delano. They field pack the lady fingers, the riberas and flaming reds. It's piecework, Rudy, so you pick them and you pack them fast and nail the lug shut and swamp them into cold storage, reefer trucks to go south over Tejon Pass through Castaic Junction into another valley. Angel Cabalas could hammer the fruit crates shut faster than the machine that killed John Henry. The seeds still warm, the flesh of the fruit still trembling. Mm. Now in winter, in the thick tule fog, they walk the picket lines in army surplus parkas outside the entrance to the DiGiorgio Ranch. Anting-anting tattoos fade on their calves and chests. Blood tugs from their limbs back to their hearts. They huddle around the fires in 50-gallon barrels, remember their women, and they dream histories of Lapu-Lapu, the warrior king, who killed Magellan in his armor in the shallows with a fire-hardened wooden stick and a bow and arrow. During the strike, I hung around the edges of their fires, warmed my hands, darkened my face over the smoking drums, installing in my silent ear the bravery of others. Now I try and reconstruct it all. I try to get it right, but I was a boy looking out at the world of men through his thick, horn-rimmed glasses. But they still tell the story in Mochi's Bar of Angel Cabalas in the Jamara cold storage, who fought his way through 5 Anglos and laid them out cold with a 22-inch bamboo Eskrima stick. Rudy Salete, Julian Baladoy, Lucky Lucai, those slick-haired island boys who carried their silver stars and faded purple hearts in beat-up wicker suitcases from labor camp to labor camp. They are as real now as this poem, which stands on firmer ground than history.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's really great. It all disappears if it's not kept somehow.
Yeah, I've been thinking. I think a lot about that, actually. It all disappears unless it's kept somehow, and poetry and literature are one of the ways to keep it. And so I feel real good about a lot of the things that I write, because I know that I'm honoring and singing to people that have done important work that gets disappeared, you might say. Yeah.
Right. Who lived lives of value.
Who lived lives of value. That's right.
Yeah.
Another one?
Yes, definitely.
This is a short one. It's called Prodigies of the Loaded Gun. And, you know, people think of Prodigy as being a young artist who's especially talented. But the word actually means as well a kind of prediction of something that's going to come. And so using it that way, this poem's called Prodigies of the Loaded Gun. Years ago in Barcelona, Gabriel, and this poem's for Gabriel Celaya, who's just died recently. He's also a very well-known Spanish poet. Years ago in Barcelona, Gabriel, I heard you read your poem. La poesía es una arma cargada de futuro. Poetry is a weapon loaded with the future. Prodigies of the yet-to-be-delivered morning of the makers, if we can call them that, whose distant love isn't just that smoking mirror rolling through the world that changes everything into an image of itself, as you would have it be. It is that courtesan, a little whore, you called her, transformed before the eyes of everyone who loves her in a different way, for whom she is the one and only love. It is the consummated knowledge in the beating of a heart you chose to wear outside your body that cannot be created or destroyed, just changed from shape to shape. Yes, Gabriel, some hearts are worn outside the body, like a moving target, like a sidearm, hair triggered to the touch. A poem, that weapon loaded with the future, that kicks back in my hand, that I stare at in amazement when it fires. This is a fairly new one. It's called Something Akin to Spirit. And it starts off with a little epigraph about the different ways that people look at the night sky and the different ways that people name the constellations depending on what culture they come from and when they live. This says, the Assyrians called the constellation Aries the hired man, and they called Pisces the swallow. The Chinese divided their night sky into 31 regions, the three enclosures, and 28 mansions. You said that in your sleepless reveries, when all is unfettered absence, and you can't remember what it feels like to be unshuttered in the presence of another, that you feared that time lives outside of mercy. When you cannot remember the voices that called you to the long, unbounded tables of yesterday, or the breeze that pleasured your bare arms and neck as it passed through the just thrown open windows, or the door you stepped through to join the others under the open canopy when it rained, where the men danced with their arms around each other's shoulders, and the women held hands and moved in a circle around them, clockwise against counterclockwise, both inscribing a larger circle, Withershins, in the opposite direction, of the sun. But there are moments when something akin to spirit can sear the flesh, etch itself into time, into the rock we all come from. Birthmarks, prison tattoos, and ritual scars. A misericordia that blooms in the palms of supplication. Something akin to the legendary spring of that year you told me about, that everyone remembers differently, and the constellations and the rivers we have given so many names. The constellations are slowly drifting from their old familiar places, until one day our children will only know them from star books and our memories of the night sky. Nevertheless, their light will roll through the canopies of heavens and continue to stream in upon us from all sides, even if it never shines in the same place twice. We are living now the past we will become, and that others may remember in their different ways. The dream of paintings and handprints in forgotten caves, the perished walls of fire and the embers in the circular ruins, all the vanished things these words inaugurate and others will remember, and what we share now between us, these unshuttered moments, are not really lost in time, are they? They will be like the legendary spring, those rivers, those constellations we've given so many names and that we remember in different ways. This next one's called Empty Sleeve People, and it's short, and it came about quite a while ago when the really bad killings were going on in Rwanda. And so I was reading a book about Rwanda, and at the same time I was looking at a book of poems that I had to pull some stuff from, and it was a real postmodern poetry. And I kind of got what the guy was talking about, but it was pretty remote for me. It was sort of like language poetry in a way. It was hard. It didn't have a lot of meaning for me. Maybe it didn't have a lot of heart, which is something I look for in poems. But I read some things in it anyway. And so this poem's called Empty Sleeve People. And it starts with a quote from Rimbaud, famous quote, where he's talking about poetry. And he says, you know, in order to write good poetry, what you have to do is you have to have, quote, a systematic disordering of the senses. The sufferings are enormous, but one has to be strong to be a poet. So, and we know that Rimbaud did a good job disordering his senses.
We're listening to Ed Frankel.
A fierce and courageous rupturing of language, the reviewer on your book flap said. Fresh and dangerous possibilities as you map the everlasting no. The slippage of signifiers and the collapse of meaning. You say your words have gone transparent, the way they work against themselves, the way they all implode, that there's no history to speak of, just the stories we tell ourselves before we fall asleep. You shake your head, and you have no use for metaphors. Meanwhile, the empty sleeve people carry around stones that they roll in their mouths, memories in their flapping sleeves, of the windowless rooms where it all came out so clean. In another room, packed and waiting for the future, words rise from the page, shrouded like crows. They yearn to be the footprints of vanished feet, friends who memorized poems that they carried under their tongues about the pleasures of the shared and common corn, passwords in the whisper and touch of contusion. Then again, maybe you're right. A systematic disordering of the senses. If they melt in your mouth or have gone transparent, words can never join bone back to bone. So I hope your tattoos never fade, that the corks all come out clean, that you and your companions stay bright-eyed and slender, and your desires hard as stones, that your words slip their layered mornings and drift away wherever your words drift away to, that your poems stay fierce and fresh and clean.
Bravo.
Thank you.
Ed, what do you make of the world today?
What do I make of the world today? We've had that talk. I think it's a... sad place where too many people are suffering, where we're not doing justice to a planet that deserves the justice that all living things deserve. And so I don't know that I'm particularly hopeful, but there's a saying in Jewish, you might as well be a mensch. And the might as well is really important, because it means, you know, if you've got nothing else to do, you might as well do the right thing. And so, I suppose that's the way I see it, that all of us can dig in where we are and try and do the right thing. And no matter whether we think it's going to work well or not, we have to assume that we do the right thing, and that's a good place to start. So I'm guardedly hopeful.
Yeah. Might as well.
might as well be a mensch. Yeah, I like that.
You want to take last licks?
Last licks. Last licks. This is last licks.
I love your poetry.
Thank you very much. So this is, I suppose it goes along with doing the right thing. This is called My Horse to Ride, and it's a kind of blend of some things that that I've kind of experienced. But it comes from a line that my wife gave me, actually. She was working with a guy who, a real cowboy, actually, from here. Well, actually, not from Sonoma County, but a little farther north into the west. But he was a real cowboy. He came in. He had lung cancer. And she diagnosed it, and she told him what he had. And he said, well, I guess that's my horse to ride, isn't it? So that line comes from Chris. And the rest of this is sort of self-explanatory. My horse to ride. I found you looking at the table that you'd left the way it was the night before, the way you always do. The empty reposado bottle, the food-stained plates, the caballitos, the little horses, the four tequila glasses sticky with the pleasures of the residue. Our talk of Hemingway, who writes hard and clear about what hurts, who you saw as a young boy in a big man's suit who needed guns and booze to feel alive. You liked the spareness of his prose, but in his book about the fishermen, you sided with the swordfish and the mute, unspoken sea. I loathe bravery, you said last night, the bravado and the posturing, but I cherish courage, which must come from the heart. I always feared Achilles, but loved dear Hector most of all, the holder of babies, as well as the breaker of horses. And my heart goes out to boys, you said, who have to harden up to make it in the world of men. You looked as if you saw some stalking horse of memory, unbidden and unnamed, that leaned a now familiar weight against your side to tell you with the aftertaste of night how to quicken and distill into your silence the alluvium and easy dregs of all those moments that you've loved. I am your horse to ride. My horse to ride, a story you told me last night about a patient years ago, right out of All the Pretty Horses and The Crossing, books that you refused to read, rodeo broken bones, big leathery hands, the tight-lipped kind of man who'd spit if he had nothing more to say. He was coughing up blood, and you had to tell him he was dying. My horse to ride, he said. No family when you asked for next of kin. When he came to the hospital the final time, he dropped the keys to his truck and trailer in your hand. I told you all the pretty horses, and the crossing ends with both young cowboys weeping like Achilles, who rubs ashes in his hair in mourning for Patroclus, then weeps again with Priam, who kneels to kiss the hand that killed his son. Achilles serves them both a meal and they sleep close by till morning. But you preferred those endless Sunday afternoons when my uncle sang and played guitars and mandolins at the long, unbounded table and even danced. I remembered how you smiled and nudged me with your elbow when my father and my Uncle Frank took each other by the neck and hugged each other close, the way men in my family always do, and then they kissed each other on the lips.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We've been enjoying the company of Ed Frankel, poet. You can find him if you want to. EdFrankel.com, I suppose, is one way. Good stuff. Better than that. Very good stuff. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
It's Monday, March 26th, 2012. You're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California, the What Now Show, Mondays 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'll be back with you in a few minutes.